I have lied to you. I am going to skip, actually not so much, but I'm going to skip the object-oriented part of this week and go directly to the first lecture for next week on Tuesday, because I'm not going to be here on Thursday, and I have not found anybody to take the class for me. In which case, if I don't find somebody to do that, we won't have class next Thursday. So I'm going to essentially shift the two lectures up a day. So we're going to cover Tuesday's lecture today and then Thursday's lecture on Tuesday. If I find somebody, I suspect what will happen is they'll proctor the quiz and then that will be it. Otherwise, I don't anticipate finding anybody, so we will just have a little vacation, which I will have to make up somehow. And I think I'm going to do it brutally by just saying, by fiat, the extra class is going to be at this time period, like it or lump it. I will consult your schedules to make sure I pick a place that at least does not interfere, if I can, with any of your courses. As to whether it interferes with other activities, I can't say, and I don't care. Questions? This represents the fourth chapter. I'm shuffling around the order of the chapters. Next week, we'll cover chapter 4, which is the big chapter. It covers classes. There's a lot of stuff that we have to cover here. And then the week after that, you'll go to chapter 3, which is the procedural stuff. It's stuff that you should be able to knock off in a half an hour. Well, maybe not. Maybe take you a whole hour. But it is material that you should be well acquainted with in your prior experiences with any programming language, not necessarily an object-oriented one. Talk a little bit about object-oriented programming, this time in a more pragmatic way. Then we'll talk about basic class syntax and then fine points for class execution. There's a lot of diddly little points that you have to get right, or I don't know that you have to get them right, but you should at least know that they're there. So if you run into problems, you have a couple of points to go to see whether or not the problems you're having are a result of variable initialization or whatever the issues are we're going to talk about. This is similar to C++, although not nearly as bad. C++ just has mind-boggling problems associated with variable initialization, global variables, and so forth and so on. Java is not quite that bad, but there are still a few things that you have to keep in mind. Let's start again with object-oriented programming. The idea behind object-oriented programming, one of the many reasons that object-oriented programming, object-oriented X actually, design, analysis, programming, so forth and so on, is so hot, or at least was accepted as being a really good idea early on, and still people think is a good idea today, because object-oriented programming spends a lot of time trying to model things, and model things in a way that the ordinary person, the non-technical, non-experienced person, can understand. That's why object-oriented analysis is such a big deal, or at least in theory anyway. Of course, that's not quite true, because the simplicity at the conceptual level suddenly turns into mud when you actually try and do something. And of course, anybody know what the name of the biggest mud pile is? UML, you've all heard of it, but you probably didn't recognize what it is. Now I've just told you what it is. UML is sort of the biggest mud pile in that case. But to a first approximation, you can think of object-oriented programming as modeling a system in a desired state. And some of you may say, well, yeah, that's what programming does in anything. It doesn't matter whether it's object-oriented or functional or procedural. What's the difference? What's the difference between object-oriented programming and, for example, functional programming? We'll get to that in the next couple of slides, but here the important point is the system may or may not exist beforehand, and this is one of the reasons why object-oriented programming was taken up as being really popular. Certainly if a system doesn't exist and you're just thinking it up out of your head or wherever, you can pretty much use anything you want. It's when you have something that actually exists and you're trying to move it along that object-oriented programming, in theory anyway, and its proponents will claim, really gives you an advantage. The example that put object-oriented programming on the map in some sense is the Texas Division of Motor Vehicles. I notice here it says DVM as opposed to DMV. I wonder why that's, I wonder if that's a mistake or that's what they actually call it down there in Texas. I wouldn't claim to understand what they do in Texas, so. I will just say Texas, since I'm not a Texan, DMV, but it may actually be DVM. I'll have to check. But anyway, the idea was you had the Division of Motor Vehicles and you wanted to computerize it or modernize it or do whatever you want. And it turned into one of those sump holes where you just pour money in. Pour millions and millions of dollars in millions of millions, not millions and millions of years, but and years and not have anything at the end. And they did this two or three times. And then the fourth time they did it, or the nth time they did it, somebody said, hey, let's use this new object-oriented thing, because this was in the, I believe, late 80s, early 90s. Let's do this new object-oriented thing that people are going all wild about. And they did it, and it worked. It was successful. They brought the upgrade in, at budget, on schedule. It worked the way they wanted it to. It was great. And this is the thing that really got people's attention. Like, wow, this may perhaps be the killer app, although they didn't have that term in those days. So the Texas DVM is the prototypical example of an OO success story. In a sense, it's the thing that enabled Object-Oriented X to bootstrap itself into the minds of the IT people across the country. You may actually still see it sometime. I know when I was in graduate school, in the early 90s, that people were just going on and on about the Texas DVM example. Not so much these days, I guess, because they've learned better, I guess. So they've learned that not everything is the Texas Division of Motor Vehicles. But that's where this comes from. How do we do modeling? And this goes back to what I talked about last Thursday in terms of abstraction. So we have this big system, and we need to reduce it to conceptual tractability. We need to be able to understand it piece by piece. We need to be able to understand the whole thing, but we need some way, because we're not going to be able to understand the whole thing. It's just too big to wrap our heads around. We need to apply some techniques, and the technique that we discovered last time was divide and conquer. We need to figure out how to do that division. How do you do, given a big system like a division of motor vehicles, how do you divide that so that can be conquered? And again, depending upon the technique you use, you get different answers. In the case of object-oriented programming, one of the answers you get is, well, you divide it by the abstractions. You take a look at the system and you start making abstractions. And we talked about abstractions. Abstractions are the technique of getting rid of detail. All right, that does two things. The first thing is it simplifies because, again, you have less detail. But in addition to simplifying things by removing detail, you also make one thing look like another. Two things that were formerly separate in their details, when you start abstracting them, at least in the right way, suddenly look the same. Now they can be grouped together into a single category, and you can just think about that category. And then you can continue that process. Now I have two categories, and I have mammals and invertebrates. And now I can start doing abstractions there and go up to a higher level. So I can just keep creating higher level structures by removing detail. That's where the understanding comes in. That's where you can wrap your head around it. That's a good illustration of abstraction. I'm not throwing away these details. You know, at some point, if it becomes important to distinguish between mammals and invertebrates, we can do that because we know what the details are and we know where to find them. But if it's not important, we don't have to worry about it. So we can work up here as opposed to working down here. What that means with respect to system modeling is what you're going to do is you're going to be looking at things and trying to figure out what the basic pieces are, and then look at those basic pieces, figure out what the attributes are, and then start abstracting away. So with respect to the system model for a division of motor vehicle, and here I notice I have it in the correct way. Let me just make a little note of that so I don't forget. Well, if you think about what a division of motor vehicle does, abstracting at the highest level, you have essentially drivers that deal with DMV clerks that turn around and deal with DMV databases. This gets rid of almost everything else. These are sort of the three essential parts that you need to be able to run a DMV. Now, I'm not telling you what kind of clerks you deal with. You know, there's the clerks you come in and talk to initially. There's the clerks that come in that after you talk to the initial clerk and fill out the forms, that checks your forms, makes sure everything's okay. Then there's the clerk you talk to when you actually come time to have your picture taken and a new license issue. Right? Those are three different kinds of clerks, and I'm sure there are others that I've never had to deal with, mercifully. But, you know, they're all clerks at some level of abstraction. Similarly, with respect to database, there's probably a bazillion databases back behind there that you don't even want to know about, that you can't know about. Probably it's illegal for you to know about them. But, again, we'll just call them the database. And then, of course, there's all kinds of drivers. There's older than 18, not older than 18. I don't know what other kinds there are. There's motorcycle and commercial and so forth and so on. But, again, they're all drivers at some level of abstraction. This is how you begin to form things. And, of course, this is how you get this diagram, right? You sit down and you write all these things out. You can use lots of different techniques. One technique that I'm reading about now is use cases. You can do, what does a DMV do? When someone interacts with a DMV, what do they do? So you write that down and then you analyze it. You can use a technique that we'll talk about in a minute. And you get all these little pieces and then you start abstracting. And you get these bigger boxes, drivers, clerks, databases. These kinds of models in the higher levels are known as domain models. This is actually what we were talking about. This was a really hot topic, domain modeling, when I was in graduate school. So it's actually, I don't know what happened to it. It kind of petered out after a while. But I mentioned last time the difference between technical and humanist software engineers. I don't know if I identified myself, but I'm a technical software engineer, not a humanist. Analysis and design. So where do these domain models come? Where do they come from? Well, one possibility, and this is actually current in the web services world, is they come by agreement, standard agreement. People agree on either via convention or via standards on what a domain model looks like, and then you can describe domain models using various kinds of description languages like, anybody know right offhand? I can't think right now. It is, it's not SOAP, but it is, there's a W in it. I don't remember, but you can describe various features of a domain implemented as a web service and then discover what those services are by looking at the description. If you don't have the services of one of those, or if you don't want to use one, you don't like the definition, then you can come up with one on your own. That's what the design and analysis part of object-oriented design, object-oriented analysis is. This is actually not our concern. We are not going to spend a lot of time on this in this class. Presumably, you'll do that in object-oriented programming when you take that class, or if you go downstairs and take software engineering classes of the appropriate kind. On the other hand, as I say always in all of my classes, it's important that you listen to the problem. Doing this kind of analysis and design is an example of listening to the problem. What is the problem saying to you? Right, what are the pieces in the problem? What is it saying? This is yet another example, perhaps a lot more hopped up example, of listening to the problem than I normally talk about, but it is another example. One simple way to do this analysis, and there are lots of different ways, is what's known as noun-verb analysis. This actually, I guess, for the most part, is not considered a good approach these days. I'm not quite sure why. I think Horstman talks about it, although not in the fourth chapter. But one simple approach is called noun-verb analysis. This is a way of listening to the problem, although actually you're not listening at this point. What you do is you get your problem, description of the DMV, and you parse it for nouns and verbs. Okay, the nouns would represent domain entities. So I said drivers, clerks, databases, lines. The verbs would represent interactions between or among the entities. So, for example, I go to the clerk and say I would like to get a driver's license. And so I would essentially indicate my interest in renewing a driver's license as opposed to getting a learner's permit or upgrading my learner's permit to a regular driver's license. Or, if I'm unlucky, I would like to reinstate a suspended license. I can do all these different things. These are all different kinds of verbs that would go on between at least in the simple case, a driver and a clerk. As an example, here's a partial problem description. A driver surrenders the old license to the DVM clerk, who invalidates it. This would be an example of a use case. This is perhaps a smaller piece of a larger use case, but it's a relatively simple, well-defined interaction between the components of the problem. Now, what do you do with this? If you're doing use cases, you would draw pictures, you'd have arrows and ellipses and stick figures. But in this case, what you do is you look at the nouns. Well, you have driver, license, DMV clerk. Okay. And then you have verbs, surrender, invalidate. So these give you your components. These are probably too small a component to be considered a domain entity, although they could, I suppose, if you wanted to think of it in this limited sense, they could be domain entities. But certainly they are components of a perhaps more abstract domain entity. And then the question is, given these boxes, what's the interaction there? And, well, the driver surrenders the license, and, in fact, the driver surrenders the license to the DMV clerk, but I didn't indicate that here. You actually might want to, actually, I guess I do indicate it here. So I guess if you were really going to get into it, you would also indicate surrenders to, which is actually a part of speech I left out. Do I talk about this? Let's see. No, I don't talk about this, so let me bring it up now. What part of speech have I left out? Why am I having trouble saying surrenders to the DMV clerk? What have I left out? Those are dangerous nouns, you could think of them as being. Dangerous, of course, because it's not clear what he, she, or it is referring to if you're not careful. There's actually two answers. Here, I have no way of indicating direct objects. I'm surrendering to something. Okay, but the other thing more typically is left out is the adjectives and adverbs, which represent in a object-oriented model the attributes of the nouns. This is a pretty reasonable way to go. This is the way I do it. If I have some problem, I can't really break up into objects in an obvious way. Some problems you look at it and there's like dotted lines that says break here. That's pretty easy. But other problems you look at it and either there's no dotted lines at all, in which case you have to work, or there's too many dotted lines. You can break it up all different kinds of ways. In either of those two cases, doing a real quick, simple noun-verb analysis is a good way to get at least a handle on the problem. You don't even necessarily have to follow through on it, but at least it gives you an in to breaking up your problem. All right, so the model entities are interacting via actions, which essentially means what? The verbs or interactions would then be... Actually, let's see, do I talk about that? No, but... All right, so I have these nouns and verbs. What did I turn them into? This is my model. This is my domain model. What do I do with it? What's the next step? So this would be the analysis part. What's the design part look like? Really simply. It's actually more complicated, but...
The nouns become objects?
Yes. And the verbs become? Right. The verbs become the methods, the nouns become the objects. And like I said, the adjectives and adverbs... Well, probably more adjectives than adverbs, but I suppose in theory you could also have adverbs, become the attributes in the objects. And again, that's a really simple way to do this. It's a lot more complicated. How many people here know UML? A little bit? You've seen it before. Okay. It's actually a lot more complicated than this simple-minded thing that I'm giving you. But that's fine, because that's not this course. This course doesn't do that. So model entities interact via actions. The actions are relative to particular model entities. It only makes sense for a driver to surrender a license. It doesn't make any sense for the clerk to surrender the database. Or drivers don't invalidate. And here I have DVM clerks. That's interesting. Oh, so here's the question. How can these be represented in object-oriented programming? Although, actually, that's getting a step ahead of ourselves. The question we should be asking is, given this analysis, how can we now produce an object-oriented design? Now we can start moving into the more Java-oriented thing, so you can wake up now if you want. A class models an entity in the system being built. And the question is, oh, what entity? And that, of course, is answered by your analysis that you've done. Class decorations have the form. You have the modifiers, an optional set of modifiers, class keyword, the class name, another set of modifiers, and then a bunch of declarations. Again, similar to C++, not so many semicolons in particular. There's no semicolon there. Declarations can be instance variables or methods or constructors. This is actually not quite true. You can also have class variables here. But maybe I should do something. Maybe I should just say variables for that. As in C++, you may declare class components in any order you like. And people will get into ripping huge arguments about whether you should put, for example, all the variable declarations at the top of the class definition or at the bottom of the class definition. I believe Horstman favors the bottom. Whether you should segregate the methods by visibility or some other approach. I just generally make it alphabetic so that it's easy to look up. On the other hand, if you have a WYSI IDE, it doesn't really matter. And here's a simple example of the driver's license class, which would be one of the classes that we would extract after further analysis. Notice that we didn't have a driver's license. Oh, yes, we did. Sorry. We did have a driver's license here. And since apparently a driver's license doesn't do anything, it has things done to it, it doesn't have any methods yet. But this should look familiar from your C++ experience. Naming conventions, this turns out to be really important because if you don't do it right, people will sort of nag you to death, peck you to death, which is annoying at most. But Java programs have lots of conventions, and conventions essentially means it's enforced by peer pressure, which is why it's annoying. There are no, I don't believe there are any conventions that are enforced by the compiler, although there are some things that if you don't do what the compiler expects you to do, you can't actually run your code. For example, if you misname a class, there is an implicit relationship between a class name and the name of the file that contains the class. And if you get that wrong, everything goes through okay, except the runtime system says, oh, I don't know where this class is because there's no file of the appropriate name. So you need to get that stuff right. But that's not a convention because the compiler doesn't say to you, you know, you're creating this class, but it's in a file that has a different name. And if you think about it, that makes sense because that would be hard to do if you put multiple classes in the same file. In addition, non-conventional source may break some tools, in particular JavaDoc. JavaDoc relies on a bunch of conventions, and if you don't follow them, then, in fact, JavaDoc will break and it will say, there's something wrong here, you need to fix it. For whatever reason, Java names are in camel case. Okay, so you shouldn't do things like old max value. That makes Java programmers freak. So occasionally I just put one in just to watch them freak. But you should do something old capital M max capital V value. And the initial letter should be, in this case, because this is a variable, lowercase. Class name should start with a capital letter, although if you remember the examples I gave you last on Tuesday, I didn't follow that convention consistently. And again, if you have a reasonably good IDE, it doesn't really matter because you just point at that name and say, what is it? And it tells you, it's a class. But again, if you don't do it, people will get all freaked out and won't be able to read your code and blah, blah, blah. So it's a pain. There are some conventions that are really stupid, and I'll talk about them. They tend to cluster around generics because generics is such a pain. Now, it does make sense to follow these sort of trivial conventions because there are some more important conventions I think it's reasonable to break. So in a sense, you're saving your ammunition for what's important as opposed to just anything at all. Methods. A class can have zero or more methods. And they represent the interactions between the models, between the model components, the domain entities. Method declarations, again, should be more or less familiar from your C++ experience. You have some modifiers out front, which include things like visibility declarations, type declarations, and so forth. Oh, here's the type declaration, return type. You always have a return type on method names as opposed to C++, where you're allowed to skip them. Then you can have a sequence of zero or more arguments, and then the actual body of the method. Arguments, again, sequence of arguments, and an argument is a sequence of declarations. So you can have modifiers in front, type, and argument name. And again, conventionally, method names are camel case with lowercase first letters. There's also lots of other rules, like, you know, use a verb, and I just ignore them. But so we can add a few more methods to our driver's license if we make some up, come up with use cases in our mind. So, for example, we might want to have a method called isValid, which in this case returns a Boolean, accepts nothing, and does something to determine whether or not the driver's license is valid. And we could also have one called invalidate, which is presumably what the clerk would call, bless you, to invalidate the license. Again, it returns nothing and accepts nothing and does whatever it does to invalidate the driver's license. We can talk about constructors. Constructor is a special method, and it's special for lots of different reasons, pretty much the same set of reasons that it's special in C++, although Java has a little bit more facility, in particular with respect to interfaces, than C++ does, but it is still more or less has the same set of behaviors between the two. The constructor declaration is similar to the declaration of a method, except that you have no return type, or if you like, the name of the constructor is the return type. That's another way to think about it. You can apply modifiers to it, pretty much the same set of modifiers that you could with a regular method. It can also accept arguments, and then you do whatever you need to do to initialize the instance that you're creating. Construction in Java is much simpler than it is in C++, because C++ divorced the issue of creating instances and initializing them. That's one of the difficulties once you get into C++. That's one of the difficulties. You don't have that problem in Java. Essentially, constructors are just initialization. So that simplifies things for you, although I suspect for most of the programming you've been doing, at least here, you haven't had any need to deal with those issues. If you're out in the world doing really industrial strength C++ programming, you may have actually been bitten by that. As I said, there's no return type, or if you like, the name of the method or the name of the constructor is the same as the name of the class. Default constructors, this should be familiar to you from C++. Every class must have at least one constructor. A class without an explicit constructor gets what's known as the default constructor. It accepts no arguments and does nothing. There are no optional arguments as there are, I'm sorry, not optional arguments. There are no, initialized arguments in Java. In C++, you could have initialized arguments, right? You could have a constructor that had arguments, but yet would be a default constructor because each one of the arguments in the constructor has an initial value, which means that you call it without passing any values at all. You don't have that in you don't have that in Java, so if you see a constructor with arguments, it is not a default constructor. It cannot be a default constructor. If you rely on the compiler to give you a default constructor, this is actually not quite correct, and I hope, let me look here. Oop, except I don't use my own CSS, my printing CSS, so I'm not sure. I would hope that there would be a link at this point indicating that this is actually not quite correct. And in fact, it calls the constructor for its superclass. But since we haven't talked about that, for the moment, it's correct to just think that it accepts no arguments and does nothing, but in fact, it does do one thing. Explicitly declared constructors inhibit the implicit default constructor. Okay. Unlike C++, this is usually not a problem. In C++, a lot of things rely on the existence of a default constructor. So if you sort of create a class and don't really think that hard about the constructors, everything works. But then if you add your own non-default constructor, lots of things can break because a lot of things are expecting to get default constructors. But because you have declared a non-default constructor, you no longer get any constructor from the compiler, so you no longer have a default constructor, so all your code breaks. Anybody do this? This is probably something that may have happened to you. Anybody had this happen to them? Okay, well, you don't have to worry about it because it's not going to happen to you in Java. If you do have problems, if you, for example, write some code that assumes the existence of a default constructor, which is not a good idea, then you will have problems, and then you should essentially create a default constructor. But for the most part, it's not a problem that you have to worry about, unlike C++, where it can actually be quite a subtle problem. Although, mercifully, it's a compile time problem. Instance variables. A class may have zero or more instance variables representing the model state. This would then, for example, indicate whether or not a license is expired. If it's not expired, even if it is expired, it would indicate, for example, who the license was issued to, what the license number is, so forth and so on. Instance variable declarations follow pretty much the declarations for methods in Java as well as C++. You have a bunch of modifiers in front indicating, for example, visibility, duration, such like. Then you have the type and then the variables themselves. Variable declarations are the name of the variable, a sequence of one or more names, and then each variable name is an actual lexical name followed by an optional initialization. Again, this should be familiar to you from C++. And again, conventionally, a variable name is camel case with a lower first case letter, so it's the same format as the names of methods. We can put some instance variable examples in here. Driver's license has, for example, license number as a string and a Boolean indicating whether or not the license is valid. Notice that in all of these cases, there are no other modifiers here. These are just the type names of the variables. These are the return types of the methods and then the constructor itself. So I'm not actually, at this point, using any modifiers. We're all looking at type names here. And, of course, the issue is, I mentioned earlier about initialization, when does this actually occur? At what point can you say that valid is true? And that's actually important when you're in a constructor. Well, let's put it this way. It could be important. You actually should not arrange things so that it is important. But if you're not careful, or if you're dealing with code in which someone else was not careful, then it's something you have to worry about, whether or not you're actually doing initializations at the appropriate time and accessing them after the initialization has been done. This is actually a problem when it comes to threads more than anything else, which is not something we're going to talk about in this class. And of course, the other question is, well, what is license number? That has no initialization. What does that initialize to? Here's the summary, the syntax summary for classes. Again, you can look it up I don't think Horseman has it, but you can certainly look it up here if you want, or online would be a better way to look it up. Any questions about that? Again, it's pretty straightforward from your C++ experience. All right, now we can start to look at those modifiers that I've been skipping over here. So a class's non-constructor methods and instance variables, which are collectively known as the class's fields, are accessed using dot notation. Okay, so class instance dot field name. Unlike C++, the only reason to access a Java class method is to call it. And what else could you do with a class method in C++ other than call it? And the reason I mention this is because this is something that you can't do in Java, which is a problem. Well, at least it's a problem for some people who like to do these things. Yes? Right. You can't take the address of a method in Java because, you can't take the address of anything in Java. But more importantly, you can't pass methods as parameters to other methods or other, they're actually nothing other than methods in Java. And that is really, really annoying that you can't do that. You can do something like it, but you can't do it itself. And that's really annoying, particularly if you're the sort of person like me who does that a lot in C++ or other languages that allow you to do that sort of thing. So essentially, the only thing you can do with a method name is call it. And that turns out to be not quite true either. There's a nasty little trick, which I don't believe we're going to talk about, in which I have to see where we could fit it in. But in fact, it's really nasty. It got the department chair. He fell into this little trap too. But it looks pretty much like a method call. You have a class instance dot method name with arguments. And the interesting thing was, the interesting thing was the class instance variable was null. Okay. So this looks for all the world like you're accessing a null pointer, right? Which should result in an exception in Java, and it didn't. And the question was, why didn't it? I'll leave that up to you to ponder. Turns out to be tricky. And let's see, when are we going to be able to talk about that? I have to, what were they doing? Oh, yes. When we get to static fields, then we can come back and consider this further. But for our purposes, class instance.method name is always a call. The only other thing to note is this is all you have, class instance.field name. You don't have the arrow notation that you have in C++, although I noticed that one of the proposals for the next revision of C++ is to allow you to get rid of the arrow notation there, too, because it isn't really necessary. You know what the type of this thing is, at least with respect to being or not being a pointer. So you can pretty much inference, the compiler can pretty much inference whether this dot means dot or whether it means arrow. But in Java, as well as most other object-oriented programming languages, you only have dot, you don't have arrow. I occasionally find myself writing arrow in Java, which doesn't work too well. Self-access. Bless you. Again, we have methods that operate on state in instances of objects. How do they get access to that particular instance state? Well, just like C++, you use the word, the keyword, the pseudo keyword, I guess, this. So in the case of is valid, for example, you might want to essentially first, for some reason, call invalidate and then return whether or not this is valid. And as I indicated, that's probably not a really smart thing to do. The semantics here is pretty much the same. So this, what does this represent in C++?
The class
Well, not the class, but the...
object.
The, I think I have a little discussion about terminology. So, yeah, I'll take object now, but in a little while that will be kind of a suspect term. So it represents the instance that the method is working on. Where does this come from? Right, but how is that communicated to the method itself? Right, because this method can be applied to a vast array of instances, all of them being licenses, but they're all different. So how does this know which one to actually provide access to? Not a variable, because, well, you have to be a little bit more careful. What kind of variable? I'll let you sweat on this, because actually it's important. What?
A constant.
Not a constant. No, it's not a constant, because it changed. Well, let's skip that.
Okay.
It's a constant relative to a particular instance, but it varies from instance to instance. So whether you want to call that a constant or not, but that actually wasn't what I was thinking about.
Isn't the reference that calls the method passed to it?
Right, but the question is how is it passed? That's you're almost there.
On the stack is almost as a parameter.
Exactly. This is a hidden secret parameter. It actually is passed in as part of the arguments to the method. Except that you don't see it. Now, Python is slightly different. Python makes you actually put it in there. Okay? You have to actually pass in this to the method, which is one of the reasons I don't really like Python. But most languages, most object-oriented languages, will hide that and do it for you automatically. So this is actually a parameter. And this is a use, and of course, this is overloaded now at this point. But the variable, the pseudo variable, this, you can think of as a hidden secret argument. And that's a useful way to think about it if you get into trouble in terms of thinking about what a particular method is doing relative to the instances that it could be working on. It's also useful to think about with respect to statics, which we'll be talking about. Actually, we'll be talking about that all throughout the semester because static is one of those things that's heavily overloaded. It's an example of too simple a syntax in Java. The point here is that this is essentially the same semantics that you have in C++. All right, so if you're familiar with what you, if you're familiar with this from C++, you can pretty much carry that knowledge over to Java. Although mercifully, mercifully, it's a lot simpler. For example, you don't have to worry about const. Generally speaking, however, references to this can be omitted. You don't have to. Sometimes I'll actually put them in to emphasize that I'm calling something from this instance. But if you find yourself in that situation, you should probably stop and think about why you have to do that, and perhaps think about ways to rearrange things so that you don't have to do it. So in this case, you would write something not like this, but more like that. Again, nothing too different from your C++ experience. The one place where that's not true, unfortunately, and this is a difference from C++, is in the constructor. And this is actually the recommended approach. Again, this is the convention that you're supposed to take. I don't follow this. This is one of the conventions I don't follow because I think it's dumb. But the idea is you have a instance variable that you would like to initialize via the constructor. So what you need to have is a parameter, formal parameter in the constructor that will accept the value that you want to initialize that instance variable to. The convention is the name of the parameter should be the same as the name of the instance variable. And to a certain extent, I can understand that. On the other hand, you could also argue very easily that that's bad form. So if we are going to initialize the license number from outside during the construction, then we need to pass in a variable called license number. Now we have a problem, right? Now we have a scoping problem because we have something called license number within the scope of the method, and we also have something within the scope of the instance that's called license number. So if I just have this not going to do very much. It's going to assign this parameter the parameter value. So you actually, when you have something like this, you actually need to use this dot to distinguish this, which is the instance variable, from this, which is the parameter. Everyone got that? The alternative, of course, is to do this. Give the parameter a much shorter name. Just call it ln, and then assign license. Now there's no difference. Now there's no name clash here. This is interpreted to refer back to the license number in the instance, as opposed to the parameter name, which is now ln. Names of this form are frowned upon in Java. People will give you a hard time, saying, oh, you should give them descriptive names. I just tend to ignore that kind of comment. The only time you're not going to get something like that is when you have a loop index. Using I is fine. That's one way to initialize instance variables, is to pass in the values through the constructor. Java, on the other hand, requires that every variable always contain a defined value. Now, the important thing to remember here is that defined does not necessarily mean sensible. Essentially, it means, among other things, that you don't have a garbage value there. You always have a value in there that the either compiler or runtime system knows what to do and how to deal with. Okay, and be able to produce sensible results as opposed to having just random stack-based garbage as in C++. When instance variables are created, they have to be initialized to obey this property. This is the point here. And this is where initialization comes in, the issues associated with having instance variables be initialized. Similarly, with respect to local variables and methods, which we haven't got to yet. So the default initialization values are considerably simpler than they are in C++. The instance variables without explicit initialization receive a default value at class instance creation. So when the class is created, they'll receive their default values. So for example, in this case, it will receive the default value of null because this is a class variable, class reference variable. The default value depends upon the variable type. This is similar to what it is in C++. You can also explicitly initialize. You can override the initialization provided by default by providing an explicit initialization using the syntax that I showed you before, example of which is here. The initialization value is computed at each instance creation, which can actually cause some problems. I've actually run into that where I needed to have the same value that was computed at runtime, because I didn't know what it was at compile time, but had to be the same for every instance. So that was a little tricky to deal with that. The important point here is that if you use, and this is a general expression, you can put whatever you want here as long as it's typed correct. And now if you have a function, that means that every time you create an instance, you're going to call that function. So if it's an expensive function, you need to be careful. Think about whether you really want to do it that way. You can also use constructor initialization. So there's essentially three steps here. There's the instance creation initialization. Then there is the explicit initialization in the declaration. And now we have a third case where you call a constructor. We've seen examples of this where we're passing in, for example, a license number, the is valid, is turned to false. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but that's, you can certainly do that syntactically. Whether it makes sense in a larger scheme of things is a separate issue. And of course, this differs from C++. You can have an initialization list in C++, and the license number in the instance variable can be separated from the license number in the parameter. So you can actually have these two things being assigned to one another, and the syntax will distinguish it. But of course, initialization lists in C++ have lots of other problems, so I don't know that that's a very good trade-off. I like it. All right. Anybody have any questions? All right. Well, if there are no questions, then I guess we're done.